I'm Ruth Gregory. I'm from Durham in England, and my research interests are, big surprise, in gravitational physics. So I'm interested both in the way gravity sort of filters through into cosmology, into the universe we have around us and to properties of the universe, as well as more formal ends of gravity, so extra dimensions, how gravity crops up in string theory, but perhaps in a slightly less clean form than sort of supersymmetric gravitating solutions. So quite often looking at more general properties of having extra dimensions. So that's what my interest is. And what we're going to be doing over the next 3 weeks is building on the relativity course that you've already had. So I'll be going over some familiar stuff in the first week, but then we'll be looking at different aspects of gravity. So you've already done quite a bit on the, let's say, the more measurable aspects of gravity. You've looked, I'm guessing anyway, at black hole solutions. Perhaps you've also done a bit of solar system tests of gravity, I don't know, and a little bit about the Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology, so how gravity describes the universe as it is. So I'll be doing some, you know, probably doing a bit on black holes, but I'll also perhaps have an eye on how you can be a bit more general about black holes. So what does a black hole look like if we have more than four space-time dimensions, for example? So to some extent, I've got in mind the fact that some of you may be doing the course on string theory, so some bits of what I say will have sort of, you'll be able to import that and that intuition into some aspects of the string theory course. Again, it'll also feed in a bit to cosmology. So naturally, when you describe the universe, it's kind of the biggest system that we've got that we can describe by Einstein's general relativity. So again, this course is a natural assist for that one. And then I'm not sure whether you've got any sort of explorations type courses, but hopefully it'll feed into those as well. Now, I had a quick look at what you'd done with Neil's course. And so I know that I think almost everything I'm going to be saying today, you've probably actually already seen. So I think David gave what looked like this mammoth lecture. It looked like an hour and a half on aspects of differential geometry, which, you know, seemed sort of, you know, quite a, you know, quite a, covering quite, it looked like he took, I mean, I don't know, it was quite interesting. I saw the notes and I thought, oh my God, he's done all that. but I think he certainly made it very accessible. So I thought, nonetheless, I'm going to go over the material again, because if you hadn't seen it before, it's quite challenging. So I think it's always useful to hear things a second time. And I also gather that there's a few people who haven't quite made it back from the Christmas break. So again, it's probably no bad thing to not try and sort of start at some, you know, sort of huge coming in sort of way at a big pace. So before I just actually begin, things are dry, with the material, I thought I'd just summarize what the conventions are, because as with most topics in theoretical physics, there are actually choices you can make with how you describe things, and so it's good to be clear. So I take a metric signature of plus, minus, 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 so mostly minus. So I'm not sure whether that's, you know, I'm guessing David might have done the opposite, but we shall see. Although it's a convention choice when you do the Riemann tensor, I think most people do, in fact, use the same conventions, but it starts off as being taking the third index as the differentiating index on the connection. And again, although strictly you could choose to contract on the first and fourth. Again, I think it's pretty conventional that they're each a tensor as defined as a contraction on the first and third indices. I'll also set H bar and C to 1, but I'm going to keep the Newton's constant. So these are the Einstein equations. So my rationale for doing that is simply to try and keep some dimensions in gravity, and therefore, since it's gravity naturally, Newton's constant is an obvious quantity to keep dimensionful. The other reason is if we think about extra dimensions, we're going to see the Newton's constant's a derived quantity, and so its dimensionality changes as we hop through dimensions. Okay, so that's just sort of setting out conventions, just so you know you don't get surprised by the odd minus sign, particularly with the signature. And now what I'd like to do for this first lecture is just go over again the material on differential geometry. So as I say, you've already seen this, at least at some level, but I hope, you know, I mean, I'm sure some of you found it just fine, but hopefully second time around, you know, it'll kind of be much more intuitive. It's going to start sort of really getting in there. Please stop, ask questions. Since I know you've got, David was quite careful with the definitions, I may at times just refer back to that. So if we are describing gravity, gravity is a force of attraction due to matter. At least that's how we first encounter it. We're sort of stuck on the surface of the Earth because the Earth is some huge, massive object and it's kind of pulling us towards it, or that's how it feels. And so that was how gravitation was described for sort of, you see, 300 years, or am I getting my math right, 200 or 300 years, after Newton first made gravity into a mathematical theory. The difference with general relativity from Newtonian gravity is gravity is not really a force. We don't sort of think of it as so much as some active force. Gravity is a consequence of geometry. Gravity happens, things move together, not because space-time is curved. So that's why we use differential geometry to describe gravitational physics. It's sort of a slightly special force from that perspective. And so we use our basic description of space-time is a manifold. So our manifold is a set of events. I'm calling them events because it's in the context of describing our universe. So everything happens at a place where at a particular time. And the way we choose to label a place and time might be different, but we've got this notion of an independent occurrence. So we call it an event. If you were doing a general manifold mathematically, it would just be a set of points or some particular collection. And the notion of the manifold is that it should look like R to the n. So all the definitions David went through with you were all about defining what that means. What does it mean to look like R to the n? And so we have our sort of nebulous set of events, our manifold. We've got some copy of R to the n, which will just be R cubed here for sketching purposes. And then you get this notion of having some patch here of the manifold where you map it over into some patch of r to the n. So we call this patch here some set, some sort of local subset of M, and we say that it's an open set, and it maps onto some open set in R to the N. And we write our map. We could write it, well, we can really label it as we wish, but we can write our map as phi, or sometimes, as David explained, you might see it as a set of coordinates. So as physicists, we'd write this. We'd write the x, y, z coordinates of whatever these points were. And then the idea is that we could have two different open sets, which we call charts. And in this second open set, we know that on the overlap, so we, if we call these our x mu's and our second chart y mu's, on the overlap, these two functions should be infinitely differentiable. So that's the notion of differentiability. Of course, it's sort of fairly obvious that we should have that if we have our we've got to be able to cover our manifold completely with a set of these charts. Okay? So our set of charts, U alpha, is called an atlas. So that's our notion of what it means to look locally like R to the N. And so all the machinery that you then build on that is trying to lift structure, things that we know about, things that are familiar in flat space, and lift them into notions of curved space. So that was what you saw in the first part of the course. So let's just, again, recap that, because it's you know, it's quite important to get this notion of why, first of all, how we use this, what we know about our structure of R to the N, how to differentiate on R to the N, and we lift that over into our manifold. So it's quite important to kind of get a good grounding in how that actually happens. So we want, in physics, so things that we want to describe on our manifold, we want to describe fields. So we need to be able to know how to talk about scalar fields, vector fields, although I won't really be discussing them very much, spinner fields. We also want to think about observers. So we need to think about paths on our manifold. And we also, we want to be able to think about distances. So that's the metric, of course. And then ultimately, we want to be able to describe this curvature. So let's kind of take the first one, fields. So a lot of the time, I may not write it down every time, I'm going to use this notion of infinite differentiability. So C infinity means infinitely differentiable. So we define, again, we're using the structure of R to the n. So a C infinity function is just going to be a map from our manifold to the reals. It's just a number at every point on the manifold. And we want it to be differentiable. How do we define that? We say, well, we look at a local chart, U alpha. We've got our function defined on U alpha, which means that we can sort of go to our parallel description of Rn, and we can say, well, that's a function defined locally on R to the n, so that needs to be differentiable. So that's how we say this is an infinitely differentiable function. And then we sort of collect all those functions together, and that forms a sort of, I suppose, vector space of functions on the manifold. So we then think, okay, now I know what I mean by a differentiable function. So let me think a little bit about an observer, which might be a curve. So a curve, on the other hand, if we think about what we mean by a curve, if we have our manifold, then a curve is just a line in the manifold. So if we want our curve to be differentiable, what does that mean? Once again, we just look at our local little copy of R to the n in some local chart. We get an image of the curve in R to the n, and then if we want our curve to be differentiable, we simply say that its image in R to the n is infinitely differentiable. So this would be for example, a world line of an observer. Or again, if I took my manifold to be the plane, R squared, and I looked at an interval, T, of the real line, which was just laid between 0 and 2 pi, then my gamma could be defined as cos t sine t. So here we've got a little interval of the reals, and we're mapping it onto the circle in R squared. So that's an example of a curve. And so just to note, the curve is not just the image of the of those points. So it's not just the circle. It tells you how fast you go around the circle. So if I'd instead put gamma was cos 2t sine 2t, it would be the same set of points, but a different curve, because you'd be going around it twice as fast. So it's important to say that the path is like the points, the events, you know. But the parameterization is telling you sort of how fast you experience them. And that's relevant because it comes in when we get to define vectors. So sometimes when you first meet vectors, you kind of, they seem to have two different hats, two different personalities. One way when you first meet vectors is you meet them as a sort of ordered doublet or triplet, usually, of numbers. So it would be the x coordinate, the y coordinate, the z coordinate. Or you meet vectors as little arrows. A vector is something which has a direction and a magnitude. So, but you kind of make those two pictures coincide by the notion of a position vector. So a position vector in R to the n takes you from the origin out to a point. So the vector is the arrow that transports you from the origin to the point, but also it's the ordered triplet, x, y, and z coordinates. The problem is, we can't do that on the manifold, because if we want to get from one place to another, we have to worry about how we get from one place to another, because maybe there's not a unique way of getting from one place to another. How do we decide if it's unique? You guys know you've already sort of talks about parallel transport, so you know there are ways of deciding how to get from one point to another, but that doesn't mean to say they'll work in all situations. So if you're sitting at the North Pole, you've got an infinite possibility of ways to get to the South Pole, all of which would look sensible from that perspective. So, so instead, what mathematicians do in differential geometry is they take this notion of the arrow, something with a direction and a magnitude, and use that geometric picture of a vector and say, how do you construct that on a manifold? And so to construct that, you use these curves. You've got a curve here. The curve has a particular direction. It's a set of points. So we know where it is and we know where it's headed. So we know we've got a sense of direction if we kind of take a tangent to the curve. And then the parameterization is going to tell us something about the length, the magnitude. So we've got geometrically, we've got with hidden in this curve, we've got a way of finding a vector. And so that would have been the tangent vector that you saw. So here's our curve, gamma of t, sitting in the manifold. And we say that we pick a function out of our set of infinitely differentiable functions. Then if we consider the composite taking f of gamma of t, so we first take t, we go up into the manifold, that's our image, gamma of t. We then ask, what is f of gamma of t? That gives us a real number. Then we've got a map from the reals to the reals. So we now got a real valued function, so we know what to do. We can differentiate it. And so we say our vector is an operator acting on C infinity of M, giving us an element of C infinity of M. And the way we decide what's its image, we take the derivative of the real function f of gamma of t. So that's our definition of a tangent vector. And of course, it has to be true for all functions, not just a special one that you've picked. What makes this an independent geometric construction is saying it's got to be true no matter what f I chose. So that tells us what this linear operator t is, or our tangent vector. So if we change our parameterization, can change the magnitude. I'm going to use inverted commas because we don't have a notion of length, but we do in the underlying Rn. So if I choose a different path, in general, I'm going to get a different direction. So if this was my original gamma of t, this would be my tangent vector t, denoted pictorially. If this now is some gamma tilde of s, then this would be a new tangent vector s. And then the set of all such tangent vectors at P forms a vector space. So I think David did cover this, but basically how you do it is, again, by using your sort of parallel right-hand side r to the n, you can construct, at least locally to p, you can construct a curve, sort of gamma tilde plus gamma, where you add together in the underlying chart the two points of the gamma and gamma tilde, and then your tangent vector there is going to be somewhere sort of in between s and t. So you can see how to construct the sum of tangent vectors. So this is the tangent space, Tp of m.
Can you please explain this part again about the adding of the curve and what its significance is?
So what I'm trying to do is to give a geometric way of addition. So having a vector space, there's various sort of axioms a vector space has to satisfy. You've got to be able to add your vectors together to get another vector, and you've got to be able to rescale them. So this is what you're kind of looking at. How do I rescale a vector? How do I add them? So to rescale a vector, that's relatively straightforward. You just go along the curve at a different rate. So when I had the example of the circle, I said, oh, I could have put in 2t, and the thing would have had the same image, but it's a different curve because you've gone around twice as fast. So in that case, if I just annotate the diagram a bit, if I went round twice as fast, so if I took cos 2t sine 2t, then my first tangent vector, let's take it over here, might look something like this. Yep. And then the second one would be twice as long. So that would be t prime. So rescaling is relatively easy, but in order to actually add vectors together, you're sort of somehow having to go across sort of both curves at the same time. So if you have your image of, so here you've got one, the sort of x mu of t, if I use coordinates. And this could be our y mu of s, which intersect at the image of p. So once I'm down here, I can see that if I want to now, what I've got to do is zero my parameters at, so here this is t is zero and s is zero. So I guess, let me see. So what I guess I want to do is, in this case, I have, because I haven't put the zero of my coordinate system at P, I think what I really want to do here, sorry for making heavy weather, but I'm just trying to remember this as I go along. Work. So the notion here is that if you have your, what you want to do is you want to construct something whereby if you're at lambda equals zero, you're at the point P. Yep. And then in order to get at some point delta lambda, you go a little bit along x and you add the displacement of a little bit along y. Yep. So you've gone to this point here. So that's, I guess, what I'm trying to sort of the construction that I'm envisaging here. So you're really constructing some curve locally to P, which is somehow the sum of the two different S and T curves. And so you can't necessarily do it globally, but at least locally, you're okay with that. You know, you can do it using the underlying structure. So that tells you how to combine. Yep, sorry.
I have a question. So there might be a lot of curves that have the same tangent vectors, right? So this is
at P. Yes.
So you're defining this kind of an equivalence class of those sort of curves, right?
Yeah. So in the sense that the number, the tangent vectors are going to span this vector space at P, you see that by thinking about the different directions in which you can go, at, you know, but as you hit P and go through it, you see what you, that there are going to be, in general, some number n, where n is the underlying, you know, dimension of the manifold. So there's n different directions you can go in. But as you say, I mean, there's an infinite number of curves through the point P. So that will give you, I mean, obviously, there's an infinite number of different vectors, even in R to the n, but your, that doesn't mean your vector space is infinite dimensional. It's just saying that, well, you know, you can construct it out of perhaps just three, if it's three-dimensional, three basic vectors. So the this is kind of giving, I'm trying to sort of give the visual description of what, you know, what the vectors look like. A given tangent vector is associated with a gamma of t, but as you say, there could be another curve that just happens to coincide at p, just the same tangent, just the same rate, and it would be the same geometric element of tp of m. Yep. Because I realized as I was writing it down that if I didn't subtract p, then at lambda equals zero, you'd have p plus p. So you wouldn't be there, you'd be somewhere up there. So I needed to zero my coordinates. So really what I should have done was chosen a coordinate system that was zeroed at p, but I didn't when I sketched it. So I was doing it on the hoof a bit. Sorry about that. Okay, so that's how we define a tangent space. It's how we define a vector. And then, of course, that's simply at the point P. And then if I take a different P primed in my manifold, I can construct a tangent space there. It's not the same vector space. But obviously, it has the same structure. It's still a copy of R to the n. So what you really have to do, yep.
So they're not the same vector. So they're copies of R to the n, but in what sense are they different?
Not the same. Okay. So as a vector space, structurally they're the same, but they're not the same in the sense of they're at different points. So this underlies, when you do differentiation, this is what underlies the notion of a connection. So they're not exactly the same vector spaces, because in order to, I believe David talked about diffeomorphisms, maps between manifolds. So we can map R to the n onto R to the n. We can say x goes to x, y goes to y, z goes to z. Or I could say, let me instead map things where x goes to something like x plus y on root 2, y goes to y minus x on root 2, z goes to z, okay? That's also another, actually, I'm choosing things that are all fairly special maps, but never mind. I think the notion is that you can map R to the n onto R to the n in an infinite number of ways, okay? So you've constructed a tangent space at P, a tangent space at P prime. They're both R to the n, but it doesn't mean x here is x there, or y here is y there. So you know there's a map between them, you know you can make an infinitely differentiable map between them, but that map might not be trivial. And that's what I mean by not the same. So, and that's, therein lies the rub, if you like, with differentiation. In order to compare things, you have to know how they're connected, Yeah. So that's what I meant by not the same. Oh, language. So, so not that I'm going to necessarily be using it a great deal or saying a lot about it. Nonetheless, I'll just note that if you collect together all the tangent spaces, it forms the tangent bundle. It's just, it's quite a sort of visual description, a bundle, if you think about sort of taking, the one-dimensional, a one-dimensional manifold, which is a circle. Your set of tangent spaces are just real lines tangent to the circle, and it's like taking, they're like sticks, you take a bundle of sticks. So it's, a lot of these words are sort of quite intuitive. So if I sort of think about the two-sphere, for example, then at the North Pole, I can go in two different directions away from the North Pole, and so my tangent plane looks just like a flat piece of paper put tangent to the two-sphere. My tangent bundle is the set of all the different flat two-planes which are tangent to the two-sphere. So I'll just say a couple of words about bases. Because TP of M is a vector space, we can think about how we choose a basis for the vector space. And so the most common basis is a coordinate basis. So in the mathematical definition of the manifold, you talked about the charts, the phis, taking you from the manifold down into R to the n, and in thinking about it, usually when we're doing calculations in gravity, we would write that as x mu. We'd write a set of coordinates. So the coordinates are really the image in R to the n of our points in the manifold under the particular map of the chart U. So if I look at each individual x mu panning through from 1 to n, then each of these x mu's is a function on the manifold. It's simply saying, oh, well, this is x, the x coordinate in this local chart, or the y coordinate in the local chart. And so we can take each of those coordinates in turn and form a vector out of it. So this leads to our coordinate basis, which we write as d by dx mu. So our notion there is that our coordinates in some patch, so I'd say the pre-image of the x-axis, for example, this is going to look a bit bizarre, but never mind, I'm just trying to sort of emphasize that the manifold could be curved. So that's sort of the notion. So our d by dx is the tangent vector to this curve here, the sort of pre-image of the x-axis. So that's our coordinate basis. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, can you explain that again? I don't see the connection between these two notions of a tangent vector. Because we're defining a tangent vector as this like sort of entity that acts on functions, right?
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the parameter of the curve and depends on the curve.
Yep. So here, so in other words, I'm writing it down. This is how we denote the coordinate basis. But for example, if this is the sort of pre-image of the x-axis, then my I would be taking df by dx, you know. So it's this notion here. I suppose it's partial derivatives that might have. It's this d by dt, the parameter along the curve. The curve in this case is the pre-image of the x-axis. The parameter along the curve is the x-coordinate. And so you're taking d by dx. Now, we use the partial differentiation here because in the end, we're kind of this. I'm going to say a bit more about this in a moment, but there's a sort of a little bit of a, I think ambiguity is too strong a word, but we tend to use these indices in slightly different ways. So sometimes this could look like the sort of 19th century physicist way of calculating with lots of indices, and sometimes this is a more geometric abstract notation. So if you can just hold that thought, I'll come back to it in a moment. But really, it is, or df by dx, right? If you want to be, it's really d by dx, where you're then saying it's that x coordinate. However, because you're doing it for all of the different coordinate functions from 1 to n, you tend to, you write it in terms of the partial derivative. It's just the way it's written. When you come to writing components of T, as we will in a moment, you'll kind of sort of see why that looks a bit more sensible a thing to do. Before I just get to that, I just want to say that another common one is the orthonormal basis, and of course, strictly speaking, you need a metric for that. But we usually denote this by EA, and we could think of that as EA mu d by dx mu. But the idea here is that if we have a metric, then the components of the metric with respect to that basis are either 1 or minus 1 or 0. So that's the idea. You need a metric for an orthonormal basis, but it's kind of saying, well, either you can choose your coordinates, or you can say, I want my basis vectors to be mutually orthogonal and of unit length. Well, that's only sensible if you've got a notion of measuring angles and distance for which you need the metric. But so let me just say with a general vector, So a general vector T, the geometric vector T, will have components. It's going to be a sum. I'm obviously using the summation convention here. It's going to be a sum of numbers times the basis elements. And so here, you know, this is this coordinate basis. And these here, these T mu's, are the components of the vector T in the coordinate basis. And they are numbers. So just to take this promised little aside, Penrose thought or tried to be formalize what physicists were doing for the benefit, I guess, of mathematicians, to maybe because it is a bit like a different language sometimes, and called it the abstract index notation. So although here T mu are scalars, components, often when we're doing calculations in gravity, we actually do a bit of a shortcut. We often use T mu to denote the actual vector. Okay? So I'm just pointing this out in this sort of first preliminary part, the more mathematical or formalism part of the lectures. I may use both, but I'll try and be clear about what I'm using and when. Once we get on to applying gravity, it'll be almost all abstract index notation, mainly because we have a lot of objects with a lot of indices. We've got the Riemann tensor, which is a four-index object. And if we try and stick religiously to geometric notation, it becomes a bit cumbersome for actually getting physical results out. However, it's quite useful nonetheless to have, you know, to have this sort of parallel notion of the actual geometric construction, because quite often, for example, if you do supergravity, you're often using a little bit more of a formal construction of the geometry, so you tend to be using this language a little bit more. So I'm just pointing it out that there is this ambiguity. We use T mu to denote the vector, but in here, these are a set of scalars. And we'll see this when we're talking about the connection. So for example, and you should have seen this, you might say, well, I know how to take a derivative of T. I would say it's a partial derivative plus a connection term. Okay? This is abstract index notation, because I've taken a derivation of a vector. Made this smaller, but it's proper. Can everybody see this, or shall I shift it? Rewrite. Taken the partial derivative, and I've added on an extra piece. Okay, so this is like the derivative of the coordinates or components, but this bit is saying that you're adding the extra piece because it's the vector part. So this is where you're saying it's abstract index notation. So what we'll see is that when we do differentiation, we'll differentiate the geometric object, which means we differentiate both pieces. The first piece is saying d mu t mu, derivatives of scalars. The second piece is about the vector. So we'll see these two terms coming up by looking at both parts of the geometric object T. So just to wrap up, I want to just So if we have a vector space, we can construct a dual space. By looking at maps from the vector space into the reals. So that's how we construct a dual space. And we label it with a star. So the dual of TP of M is TP star of M. And it's a set of linear maps from the vector space into the reals. And so we would denote this by either. So sometimes I use a sort of Brahn-Ket notation. Or you might see this type of thing. Now, if we've got a metric, it's kind of obvious what's going on here, how to construct a dual space, because you can think of a dot product. A dot product takes you, your metric gives you, takes you two vectors and gives you a number. A real number, like, you know, which is telling you about the angle or the length of the individual vectors. And so here you would say, okay, well, if I only took one of them and took the metric, then that would kind of pull the index downstairs. So that's the sort of thing, if you, you know, with the knowledge of the metric, you kind of see what's going on. But you don't need a metric in order to do this. You can simply just consider these linear maps from your vector space down into the reals. It's also a vector space, and it's known as the dual space. And so component-wise, if we have coordinates, we now denote our dual basis by dx mu. And then the dual basis in general I'm going to denote by omega A. And the idea is that omega A of EB equals the Kronecker delta. So that's how you construct a dual basis. So here, you know, this is obviously a function. It's either 1 or 0. And that's sort of that's how you find it. And then for a general, so we call the elements of these this cotangent space, this dual space a cotangent space. So if I have something like, what am I going to call it? Call it capital omega. So you see that you've got omega with t. Run out of space there. So you can see that this looks something like the familiar contraction of a covector or covariant object with the vector t. So just to finish off, I'll just recap what happens when you change charts. So or, as we would say, a coordinate transformation. So our vector t is equal to t mu d by dx mu in a coordinate basis. And we know that that's the same vector if I write it with respect to a different basis, in particular, a different choice of coordinates or a different chart. But I also know that this is a differentiable manifold. So if I have a choice of coordinates, or it means that I'm on an intersection of two charts, and I know that I should be able to differentiate my coordinate transformation. So here we start to see why we put the partial derivatives. And so I can rewrite my basis vector d by dy. I know has to be expressed in terms of the coordinate basis d by dx. And so the components of d by dy in the d by dx coordinate basis are none other than just these transition functions dx by dy. And so this tells me, if I put this read off, tells me that t mu is dx mu by dy nu, t nu. So this is our usual coordinate transformation for vectors. And then we see that for covectors, it goes the other way. We use the inverse coordinate transformation, which is covariant. And so this makes a link with a sort of very traditional or 19th century way of looking at vectors or covectors. So it sort of steps back. It's not sort of quite using the same pictures of the geometry. And then, of course, you construct tensors by looking at multilinear maps. So the vector was a map from C infinity of M to C infinity of M. The covector was a map from the vector space to the reals. And so you build up tensors by looking at sort of multilinear maps. So for example, if I took a map from TP of M cross TP of M to the reals, that would be like a second rank covector. And so that's sort of how we build up the tensor algebra on our manifold. So tomorrow, I want to look at differentiation, but I'm not going to do covariant differentiation initially. I want to look at more general forms of differentiation on the manifold. So we'll first, the reason I wanted to do this coordinate transformation is because we want to just remind ourselves of what goes wrong when we try and take partial derivatives of things like vectors. And then to use that and to use a sort of a little bit of think a little bit about what a derivative means to think about how we might fix what went wrong and what can we do to make a derivative that works. So we look at the Lie derivative, exterior derivative, and then we'll come back to the covariant derivative, which you're familiar with. So any questions? I mean, it should be a revision lecture today, more or less, but hopefully it's been useful going over it again. Questions? Well, I've been told your next lecture is cancelled for those of you doing that. So we We actually have plenty of time. So I'm going to turn the mic off since the formal part of the lecture is over. But
what I'd like to do actually is just sort of ask, were the bits, what bits did you like about general relativity and what bits were less, I don't know, what bits did you feel more scary?
I can do the mathematics for the most part. It's just when I think you look at the equation, I guess it comes with practice with the intuition. You can't, at least I can, when I just looked at things, I couldn't pick out the physics.
Okay, so you feel like you're going through a load of manipulations.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, I think that's a fair comment. I think when you kind of first meet GR, there's a huge amount of formalism there, and there's a lot of machinery, and it kind of takes becoming quite comfortable and you know, just keep doing the machinery before you don't think about it, and then you're starting to think about what you're trying to do with that machinery. But it is quite a lot. So I think all I can say is I think the more you do, you'll probably find that it does become more intuitive. So sometimes with some of the things I write on the board, I'm aware that I may be, you know, if there was a pure mathematician in the room, you know, they'd probably be feeling a bit uncomfortable. but it's in part because, I'm going to try and bring out, or at least that's what I think I'm doing. I think I'm trying to bring out the pictures. But, of course, sometimes, you know, you're doing so much algebra, it may not look like it. But I mean, by all means, you know, I'll stop me with some of the pictures and get me to just say some stuff again, because sometimes that can be quite useful for getting this intuition. Is there any topic anybody would really like to see in the late part?
Most of us haven't had formal courses in the country.
Right.
Be good to have.
To kind of have to refresh that and go over it again, yeah. So, I think one of the things that I'm going to cover is quite a formal way of calculating curvature. It's Cartan's formalism, so that's why, in part, why I've been introducing this notation. And the reason I quite like to do that is if people are then going to go on and do anything with string theory or supergravity, quite a lot of that language is used. But at least if you read the literature, it's not always, you know, it's just assumed everybody's sort of born with this knowledge or something. So that's one of the agendas that I have. Anything else? Is this someone who thinks there's going to be a lecture? Have you come for the quantum?
Yeah.
It's not happening. So, because there are, I think, the majority of the students on it have not made it back yet.
Oh, okay.
So,
fair enough. Yeah.
Right,
thank you very much.
All right. So, yeah. Well, okay. Anyway, please do feel free to ask questions. It's a bit, I think if they had a coffee machine out there, it'd probably be easier to just sort of have a chat after the lecture, because this is quite, you know, sort of me facing you with all the desks in between. It's fine when you're doing the lecture, but if you want to sort of ask, or sort of have a discussion, it's not quite so easy. But anyway, you will be having a tutorial on Wednesday, is that right? So, sorry, this is my student Philip, who I think will be helping. So anyway, I can, as I say, there's sort of some core topics I do, and then there's a couple. I think what I'd like to do this year is sort of work towards talking about just some some recent work I've been doing, because I think it is actually achievable in the context of the course about gravitational instantons. So I thought that might be quite fun to sort of go through stuff and then finish with covering a research paper, so that you can kind of sort of see that, you know, although it sometimes seems like it's a long way away when you start studying stuff, actually a lot of the techniques that you do in a lecture course really are what you use when you're solving problems.